to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In this expanded 20th anniversary edition of Murder of a Mafia Daughter, seasoned crime writer Kathy Scott provides in-depth new details of serial killer Robert Durst's arrest, trial, and conviction for the brutal murder of Susan Berman. Besides never-before-seen photos of Susan, also included is Durst's $40,000 mask he planned to use to elude police while on the lam. Susan Berman grew up in Las Vegas luxury as the daughter of Davey Berman, casino mogul and notorious mafia leader. After her father died, she learned about his mob connections. Susan then dedicated her life to learning about Vegas and its underworld chiefs. Her life took a bizarre turn in 1982 when Kathy Durst, the wife of her good friend Robert Durst, mysteriously disappeared. Kathy's husband was a prime suspect, but the case was never solved. After the Kathy Durst case reopened, the media leaked that the phone call that appeared to be Kathy calling her medical school dean saying she was sick and wouldn't be at school, the call was placed the morning after she disappeared. Soon after, the Kathy Durst case was reopened. Susan Berman was found dead, shot in the back of the head. No forced entry, no robbery, nothing missing from her home. This expanded and updated book covers what led to Durst's 2015 capture. Police records placed Durst in California at the time of his good friend Susan Berman's murder. HBO filmmakers discovered an envelope, unknown before, written by Durst to Susan. The handwriting and spelling of Beverly Hills was dead on match to the cadaver letter police say the killer mailed to police, informing them of Susan's death before her body was discovered. This new release covers Durst's lengthy murder trial and the slaying of his best friend. The book we're featuring this evening is Murder of a Mafia Daughter, expanded and updated 20th anniversary edition, Robert Durst and Susan Berman, the shocking inside story, with my special guest journalist and investigative journalist and author, Kathy Scott. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Kathy Scott.
You're welcome, Dan. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And congratulations on this new expanded and update 20th anniversary edition.
Thank you.
Let's start off with we mentioned it a little bit in the introduction, but what is included in this new updated edition?
Well, there are new interviews with her family and several members of her family. She had a lot of cousins, and with their thoughts on the trial, and as well as Durst died, you know, while I was still finishing the update. And I was able to include that as a final, you know, as the end to the book. And there's real finality to it. But I also watched the entire trial and added some of the testimony as it was live, you know, going on. And the beauty of it is Robert Durst, you know, he thought he was the smartest man in the room, and he testified on his own behalf. And so I was able to include some of just the absurdities, and he laughed, he mocked people. It was really pretty sad, but he, you know, I always said he was too mean to die, but he did after the trial. But so it's gone full circle now, the book, you know, the 2015, I had an edition come out with his arrest, and now the conviction. And then the New York district attorney filed charges against Robert Durst before he died for the murder of his wife, Kathy. So that's also included in the book, and a whole lot more details. And Kathy Durst's brother, I interviewed him for it as well. Just a lot of details as well, things that like the $40,000 masks that he was going to wear and go out, you know, try to go become a fugitive again. he testified about that. He admitted it. So there's a whole lot more in the book. And as I said, it's complete now. So I'm very happy about that.
We have to go back in this story and can't just talk about the trial, and because there's too much to really unpack. So as you do in the book, let's go back to how Susan Berman met Robert Durst, but also who Susan Berman really was.
Well, Susan met Robert Durst at UCLA when she was an undergrad there, and he was there for graduate school. They met in the quad and became instant friends. They had a lot in common. Bobby, to her — I call him Bobby because she called him that — but Durst to her was mysterious. He was kind of a quiet guy. And they had a lot in common because he came from money, she came from money. They both lost their mothers at a young age. And it just was an instant bond. And she always looked at him as her big brother. And then Susan's background was her dad was Davy Berman, who was a mobster in the Midwest and came out to Las Vegas in 46, I think it was, to 1946 to be partners with Bugsy Siegel. And Davy Berman ran the Riviera and the Skim. You know, the mob gets this much, the owners get that much. So he ran the casino for the Skim, for the mob, Chicago mob. And she grew up in luxury and spoiled rotten, and had she adored her father, and he died when she was 12, and then her mother committed suicide when she was 13. She went to live with her uncle Chicky, who was also in the mob, and went to private school, and then went to college, and that's when she met Robert Durst.
You talk about her career. That once she found out about her father, she was so sheltered her life that she didn't find out about her father's past, her murderous past and organized crime past, till she was in her teenager, almost 20 years old. So as a result of that, what did she do, as you write? What was the result of gaining this information, and what should she do as a result? What did she become?
Susan became a historian for her father. She wrote the book Easy Street, which was an incredible book. It's really just her entire life with her parents. And she had her father on a pedestal and bragged on when she wrote, when her book came out, Easy Street, she was on Jane Pauley's show and proudly said she read it in the book. She researched, she spent years researching her father, and anything he was mentioned in, she devoured it. And she very proudly said on national TV that her father could kill a man with one hand behind his back. And when her body was found in her house, greeting police in the house above her fireplace mantle was a wanted poster for murder for her father. And she carried around his police mugshot in her wallet. She was quite proud of who he was and thought he didn't get enough notice as a big mobster in Vegas, that others got more notice than he did. And she was trying to put his name out there and give him notoriety.
She was trained as a journalist under some very fine journalists. And so she became a respected journalist before she wrote novels and then wrote Easy Street. Tell us what the relationship was. You mentioned that they were like brother and sister, but Susan always wanted to have children. So tell us about what happened in her life for this to become a reality.
With Susan, Susan got married to Mr. Margulies. He was his dad worked for her father at the Flamingo, and she met him in line at the Writers Guild in Los Angeles, but it didn't. He had substance problems, and so they divorced, and she quickly met a man named Paul, and he had two children, and Sarah and Mila, and she met the daughter first. The boy was a little bit older, and she became a mother and a housekeeper, and you know, took care of the house the way she was raised until her parents died, because she had a family, you know, a core family in Las Vegas, was with lots of she had a bodyguard, you know, growing up, you know, who was a mobster who was assigned to her, and he stayed with her until she graduated from high school. And so she just relished that life. But she and her husband got into a theater deal, and Susan took all the money she had left. She inherited a lot of money over the years, and she took all the money she had left and put it into this project that bombed in New York. She went and spent time in New York, and she and Paul, they lived together. They weren't married, but when they split up over the film and the loss of the money, or the theater production and the loss of the money, Mila stayed with her and stayed with Susan, and Susan finished raising her until the girl entered college. So for Susan, it was a dream come true meeting him, because she had the children she wanted, that she'd always wanted.
You talk about the money that she had, and that she was spoiled when she was a kid, and every whim was entertained. Talked about Liberace playing at her birthday party, and one time she asked if he could, her father, very influential and powerful father, could get Elvis Presley to do something for her birthday. And she did get that as well. Tell us a little bit about the deal that happened, where she got a lot of money from the royalties from the casino. So in effect, the organized crime partners that he had took care of her and then gave her a significant amount of money. You talk about $5.25 million, and significant. So tell us a little bit about this deal, and regardless of that money, what kind of financial situation was she in most of the time?
Well, Susan did inherit money from the time she was 21 until she was 30. And her dad owned a percentage of timeshares in Las Vegas, a couple of casinos. I think the Mint might have been one of them, a Flamingo, and there was one other. It's in the book. And so they gave her payments. And her uncle, Chicky, until she was 21, he got paid to take care of her and provide her with things. And her cousin, who she grew up with, her older childhood, her cousins were in the same household, where their father was doting Susan with all these things. Well, he was doing it because he was getting paid to do it and told to do it. It was part of the trust because of his interest. So it wasn't really the mobsters who were paying him. It was the casinos. He had an interest, and there was a business manager who took care of it for all of them. And so they would dole out the money. I think it was, she got three large payments, one when she was 21, one when she was 25, I believe, and then another when she was 30, and that ended it. And it added up to the $5 million. And so Susan, instead of investing the money, which she could have lived off of the interest for the rest of her life and lived very well, she spent it. She also got a $185,000 advance for her book, Easy Street. And she got a movie deal that was lucrative. It fell through, but she got to keep the money, which was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. She bought a house in Los Angeles and lost it because after the theater deal fell through with her boyfriend, Paul, she went into foreclosure and lost her house. She would hit up all of her friends, and her friends didn't know. Susan didn't tell them that she had come into money and that she had had all this money until she was 30. And she would go to Elaine's when she was living in New York in her 20s. She would go to Elaine's, you know, the big Tony restaurant there, and buy everybody dinner. Mm-hmm. You know, she would go and buy custom alligator shoes or boots and get three colors instead of one. She'd get four silk shirts for herself, blouses instead of one. So she spent lavishly, and I think it was because of her childhood. No one ever gave her the tools to manage her life. Everything was always taken care of for her. She had drivers. She had, you know, everything was done for her. And she was, a poor little rich girl, basically, and who should have been able to maintain an incredible lifestyle with the money she was given, but she squandered it all. And she lived, her house when she died was sad. I mean, she had pulled the carpet up in the floor. She was living on concrete floors and unfinished, and the heat didn't work, and half her furniture was gone or broken. And she had a bed that wasn't even on a box spring. It was on the floor. It was sad. But Robert Durst, she turned to him for money. And we know that twice he gave her $25,000 payments, one right before she died because her car died and she needed a new car. So it's a story of, she joked in a letter that she had written to Robert Durst, which became part of the court record in his trial. She joked that she was going to write a new book and it was going to be called Rich Girl Broke. She didn't mind that people knew that she was broke. She hit up all her friends for $1,500, $500, you know, $1,000. They would give her money, not knowing that she at one time had a lot.
Let's talk about Robert Durst now. Again, the friend that comes from billionaire real estate magnates. This guy has homes. This guy has lived very similar to Susan Berman, probably in much more affluence as well. But Robert Durst marries a woman named Kathy. And so the relationship between Susan and Robert Durst is different. Why is that? And how did Kathy and Susan get along?
Well, Susan did a lot with Bobby and Kathy. They would go places together. There are photos of them together. When she had her book signing, Bobby was still married to Kathy, and he paid for her book launch and for Easy Street. I think there was another book signing that he did for one of her novels. What is it? Soldier, give me a gun, or what? Mm-hmm. Give me a lift. Soldier, give me a lift. And she had a book signing in New York as well for that. And Bobby was a part of it. So I don't, she got along with Kathy from all appearances. People said that they got along. She wasn't really a friend of Kathy's. She was, you know, he was the wife of her best friend and of Susan's best friend. I've talked to friends who got together and saw them together, her with Bobby and Kathy, and she always doted on Bobby, but Kathy didn't seem to mind. But at the same time, Kathy was going through a period where she was being abused by Robert Durst and was reached out to a couple of friends, but felt very isolated and was kind of into herself quite a bit, going to medical school and trying to survive her marriage at the same time. And I think she had plans to leave Robert Durst, and that's why ultimately Kathy Durst got killed.
You talk about her being killed, but the thing is she disappears in 1982. Just tell us a little bit of the circumstances that police were aware of at that time in this disappearance.
Well, Kathy Durst disappeared in 1982. And Robert Durst didn't report it for a week. She was supposed to be, it was finals week. She was in medical school. And so it was a very important day. She had a fight with Bobby Durst over her attending a party at a friend's house. And he said he took her to the train so she could go stay in their New York penthouse and go to school the next day in New York. And she never made it on the train. She never made it to school. And Susan's role in that, and ultimately, I believe, got her killed. And maybe I'm jumping ahead, but Susan was his media person. So when the media wanted to talk to Robert Durst because he's with, you know, this great big real estate mogul family. I mean, his family built the towers in New York. And he needed to talk to the media. They were requesting, you know, interviews with him over his missing wife. And Susan became his media spokesperson. Also, a phone call was made to the school, and which is unusual for a medical student at her level. She was about to graduate, and Kathy Durst was about to graduate, for a medical student to call in sick. And so a woman called in sick the next morning on behalf of saying she was Kathy Durst, only she called the wrong office. So obviously whoever called in didn't know the right place to call. And the police believed for years that it was Susan who made that call, and because she would have done anything for Bobby Durst.
So you write that police had Durst as a suspect, but very much, especially because of the high-powered attorneys that his family could afford him, the district attorney was hesitant to do anything against him, since they couldn't even get an official interview with him. They talked to him on the phone after a bunch of days. So needless to say, they suspected him, but couldn't do anything about that suspicion, correct?
Well, the interesting thing, I think the clout with the family, Seymour Durst, his father, was very powerful, and he made phone calls to the police. But the interesting thing, the interesting angle, is Robert Durst did not report his wife missing from Westchester or Salem, in Westchester County, New York. He reported her missing in Manhattan, and he waited 5 days to go. He walked into the Manhattan Bureau. I went there and interviewed them, the detectives in Manhattan. And he walked in with his dog and told them his wife was missing, and from Manhattan, from their apartment in Manhattan. And there was no follow-up with the New York Police Department, Manhattan, and then Westchester County. She lived there, but she wasn't reported missing from there. And basically the case just stalled.
With this case stalling and with the police not being able to do much with this cold case, what was Robert Durst doing in the meantime? Again, police suspected him, but he went on and was living his life. But he didn't become a serious suspect at all, even in the disappearance of his wife. What happens with a person named Morris Black?
So the Westchester police, Janine Pirro was the district attorney at the time. She launched an investigation a few years later, and Durst got, and Susan in the meantime, quickly, Susan Berman in the meantime, quickly left New York and went to L.A. saying she wanted to be a screenwriter. Susan was freelancing for New York Magazine and a few others. She was, you know, a good writer and had excellent writing gigs and worked for them. She worked with Nicholas Pelagie at the magazine, and she could have had an incredible career had she continued on, but and writing books, but I think she got spooked because of Kathy Durst, and she knew what happened to her, I believe. And she went to LA. She always liked LA, Susan did, because her dad took her there on weekend trips. And in the meantime, the police were investigating Durst. He was walking as a free man, and he was supposed to take over the Durst organization. But he was getting, you know, crazier and crazier. His behavior was odd. Durst was, and his family and his father didn't want to give him the business anymore and wanted to give it to his brother. So Durst, as the police in Westchester close in on him, Durst takes off and goes to Galveston Bay and lives as a woman, a mute woman, in a $300 a month bungalow, and his next door neighbor is Morris Black. And Morris Black figures out who Durst is, and then he gets dead. So Durst chops him up, his body, shoots him, says it was self-defense because they were fighting over a gun and it accidentally went off. So Durst chopped up his body and dumped it in bags in Galveston Bay while it floated up. So he got charged with murder, and a Galveston jury believed him that it was self-defense, and he was acquitted of murder.
Yes, you say that he was represented by famed attorney Dick DeGuren, and you can see the skills that Dick DeGuren had. If under those circumstances and all of the evidence that they had, for him to be acquitted was incredible lawyering, I think.
It was an incredible moment, yes, because, I mean, the man, he admitted killing him. There were no witnesses. Discarding the body the way he did, it was pretty unbelievable. But yes, he had the best attorney money can buy and was very active in his own defense. You know, he's very talkative when he's sitting at a defense table and tells his attorneys what to do. They believed him. And so he went on and he ends up killing three people. In the meantime, in 2000, Susan was killed and Durst was supposed to visit her in LA and go to her house sometime before the holidays. She was killed on December 23rd, we think at night, or on the 24th in the morning, and her dogs were out for 24 hours, and that's how her body was found. Neighbors complained about her dogs and called police and said something was wrong. Her back door was open, and she was rigor mortis was already gone when her body was found, so they figure it was anywhere from 12 to 24 hours earlier. Durst happened to be in town, and the LAPD, though, didn't. They said he wouldn't cooperate. They couldn't get him to interview with them. They were at the funeral waiting for him to attend his best friend's funeral. He didn't show. And the case went cold. So Bobby Durst continued living a free man.
What was it about what prompted the police to suddenly, after all this time, want to talk to Susan Berman, when essentially she had provided some sort of alibi for him, essentially? You don't really point out what exactly that was, but being the spokesperson, what was it that prompted the police after all this time to want to speak to Susan Berman?
Well, the alibi was her calling school on saying she was Kathy Durst. That's the belief. And she gave Bobby an alibi and she placed her murder in Manhattan rather than in Westchester County. What happened then with Robert Durst is why he got off for so many years. Seymour Durst called the Los Angeles district attorney and said, quit trying to contact my son. And they did. They stopped trying to contact his son, Robert Durst. And so Robert Durst lived a free man, had property in San Francisco, bought houses in New York, harassed his brother. He became really estranged from his own family and kind of just did his own thing. And Susan had a difficult time getting a hold of him when he was in Galveston and living as a mute woman, trying to hide from the Westchester County police. And her case went cold until a deputy district attorney by the name of David Lewin came along and wanted to reinvestigate the case. And then everything turned upside down for Robert Durst. Also, Durst, because he was a narcissist and thought he was the smartest person in the world, he wanted a documentary done about himself. So he approached a filmmaker who'd done a movie, was based on a true story, Kathy Durst's disappearance. Robert liked it. Robert Durst liked that movie. And so he approached the producer and said, hey, you know, would you do a movie? Would you do a documentary on my life? And they did. And that's when he made a partial admission in the film. And then the police at the same time in Los Angeles were closing in on him. And he admitted on a documentary that I killed them all. And he said he was still mic'd and he was in a bathroom and said that. And then he was arrested, I think, 2 days later in 2015. And he was never released until went to trial. It was supposed to go to trial in 2019, started the trial. COVID happened. They put it on hold for at least a year. He went back to trial.
Let's use this, Kathy, as an opportunity to stop to hear from our sponsor, which is Ritual. Gaps in the diet shouldn't be ignored. Over 97% of women aged 19 to 50 are not getting enough vitamin D from their diet, and 95% are not getting their recommended daily intake of key omega-3s. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin was formulated by exhaustive research to help fill nutrient gaps in the diets of women ages 18 plus. It is formulated with nutrients to help support brain health, bone health, blood health, and provide antioxidant support. But Ritual didn't stop there. They invested in a gold standard university-led clinical trial to prove the impact of Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin. The results? Essential for Women 18 Plus was shown to increase vitamin D levels by 43% and omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in 12 weeks. My wife Lisa started taking Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin about 3 years ago. She was very impressed with the results. So when Ritual came out with a multivitamin for men 50 plus, I decided to try it for myself. It's been well over a year now, and it has made a significant difference in how I feel every day. Right now, Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder and turn healthy habits into a ritual. That's 10% off at ritual.com/murder. Now, Kathy, you talked about finally closing in on Robert Durst. The thing is that many, and you explain this in the book, you talk about that many people that watched that documentary called The Jinx, and where on the, as you mentioned, the last episode, he was already in custody, but in the episode, he has this mic, as you mentioned, and he says things, what have I done? What did I do? I killed all of these, I guess, something to that effect. The thing is that police didn't really look at that Jinx documentary and get the information that a lot of people thought was derived from that. You talk about two other women that police were seriously investigating in other jurisdictions that had, it looked like, the signature of Robert Durst. Tell us about that, please.
Okay, first, the Jinx, the fifth episode of the Jinx was where he made that admission. Right. What did I do? Killed them all. The district attorney and police were already headed to New Orleans. They knew that he was there and were getting ready to question him. They were going to question him with the Jinx and admission that came out, because the interview with him was the day after, coincidentally, because you're right, they didn't have all the goods yet, but they were on him. With that Jinx admission, then they went ahead and they held him in custody and they arrested him and charged him. So there's kind of a nebulous, it depends on who you talk to, what came first, the police or Jinx. So the problem is Dick DeGuerin, the attorney, he said to me, and I included in my book, that Durst was in the air at the time Susan was killed. No, Durst was in the air 24 hours after Susan was killed. He was in California, had plenty of time to drive back and forth from San Francisco to LA, kill her, turn around, go write the letter about a body being in her house, cadaver letter,
right,
and then have enough time to drive back to San Francisco and fly out to New York a day later. So yes, two girls were missing. That gave, and one girl who was seen with Durst, I interviewed the police in both towns where those girls were missing. they're pretty sure of the one. They didn't have enough evidence on the other. But that gave the Los Angeles police, working with other police departments, to hone in a little bit more on him and question him. So the walls were closing in on Durst, which is why he left. And the reason he took off for New Orleans was because someone leaked to the media that Westchester County was reinvestigating the murder of Kathy Durst, or the disappearance of Kathy Durst.
Right.
And they wanted to talk to Susan Berman because she was his spokesperson, and they wanted to talk to her about whoever called claiming they were, you know, Kathy Durst to the school. That was the alibi she made for him. They wanted to talk to Susan. That was all that came out. But Susan, it came out in court. Susan told, when she finally was able to reach Durst, she told him, "What do I do? Westchester County police have called me and want to interview me and about Kathy's disappearance. What do I do?" And Durst said, "Well, do what you want." And on the stand, when he was testifying in Susan's murder case, he said, "What was I supposed to do? Say no, don't talk to them." So that Susan saying the police had called her, they hadn't called her. They put out the word that they wanted to reach her, but they had not called her. And that I believe is the reason he killed her. And that's what the DA believes as well.
And also the district attorney, despite the fact that she would get money from all of her friends, that she had rent free at a place for 5 years and then another place for a year. And so she was benefit from the largesse of her friends. But the thing is that Robert Durst, and especially the timing of these payments, had sent $25,000 and then another $25,000, and saying that it was not a loan, it was a gift. So that did feed into the idea that there was a motivation for Susan to be able to be his spokesperson, his alibi, and to keep her mouth shut all those years.
Yes, he'd given her money at other times, but people, you know, she didn't talk about it that much, so people didn't realize how much. But the $25,000 in two separate payments, one was, you know, she was being evicted from her rental house in Benedict Canyon near LA, and she was desperate for money and was desperate to reach him. And so he sent it to her. She also, and this is a key point that came out in the trial and hadn't been known until then, until Durst's testimony, she sent, when he told her he was going to come to town, which he was going to go there and kill her, but when that's what police believe, and that seems to be the motive, is and in paying her money to try to keep her quiet. He was afraid, though, she would talk, and that does appear to be the, I'm sorry, I got off track. She sent him a set of keys, and that's one thing. No, I couldn't figure it out. The police couldn't figure out, how did he get in the house? Mm-hmm. Did he knock?
That's right.
And then he shot her in the back of the head. But he had a key to her house, and she had gone out to dinner with a friend. And I believe, and I think the DA's office believes the same, is that he went into the house and waited for her. And then when she walked down the hallway toward her room where she kept her dogs crated, that's the room she was shot in. He shot her in the back of the head. She didn't see what was coming. He parked his, then he returned to the house the next morning, he said, and parked his car in front of the driveway. Just odd circumstances all the way around. But her telling him that, you know, the police wanted to talk to her, I think is what got her killed. And then he was, you know, trying to give her money to pay her off. But Susan talked a lot. She talked too much sometimes, and sort of stream of consciousness told him what she was thinking. And I think he thought she was going to talk to the police and spill the beans, and the money he gave her didn't shut her up. And so he did the dirty deed.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Kathy, to stop for a second for these messages. Now, you talked about the trial. You write about the trial extensively in this new updated edition. Very interesting that he, against the advice of his attorneys, he takes the stand to testify. And, you know, it's very interesting to see how many days they keep him on the stand, 14 days. So when we talk about some of these things that you learn, we all learn about this case, it's from that 14 days of a blistering cross-examination that he puts himself under, that some of this information, a lot of this damning information leaks out during that testimony, doesn't it?
It does. It was eye-opening. I mean, it was, you could have dropped a pin. I wish I'd been in the courtroom, but even on TV watching it. And he was his own worst enemy. But like I said before, he thought he was the smartest person in the room. He thought he was smarter than everybody. And he actually was in such decrepit condition. I mean, he looked like a walking skeleton. But there are people who believe, and the district attorney had said it at one point, that they were making him as attorneys, the way they dressed him, the way, you know, he was in a wheelchair, he slouched down, trying to look pitiful at times, you know, and he was, but he had a really strong voice during the trial. And then sometimes his voice would go up like he didn't have enough air to speak. But I do believe it was, he was his own worst enemy because he thought he was so smart. Smart as a fox, he did himself in, because I don't know if that testimony, without his testimony, I don't know that he would have been convicted. He was not a sympathetic witness at all.
No.
He laughed at people. He made fun of them. He's a very unlikable person, and it came across real well to the jury.
You write about a secret witness in this trial named Nick Chauvin. He was an advertising executive in New York that said that he testified that he spoke to Robert Durst after Susan Berman's death. What did he say, apparently? What did he say that Robert Durst said?
He said he had to do it. You know, it was either him or her, and he didn't have a choice. It was quite a moment, and it was shocking. Shocking to his friend. And he ended up speaking. He was, you know, he was afraid for his own life, which is why he was so clandestine until the trial, who he was, who that witness was. It was all kept under wraps before then. But basically he said it was either her or me. So he took her out. And, you know, one thing, you know, murder, as you know, you cover it so much, and it is the ultimate thing you can do. It is just, I mean, taking someone's life is a huge thing for the person who commits it sometimes. And for Durst, it was so monumental. I think he just had to share it. And that guy was the one who testified against him, was one of his closest friends. Bobby didn't have very many friends. And it stunned him so much that he had to tell someone.
You talk about the LAPD, Lieutenant Tom Thompson, and who oversaw this Susan Berman investigation in 2012. But he got a call from Eureka Police. And that's when they really zeroed in on Robert Durst, because now they realize that there are other people that fit his MO of... And in regards to that, they then zeroed in on Robert Durst. In this trial, which I found was very interesting too, is that they were allowed to bring up the Morris Black murder, Morris Black murder dismemberment, regardless of the acquittal. That couldn't have helped Robert Durst look sympathetic or less guilty at all at that trial, would it?
No, it didn't. But you know, they had to be careful what they said, though, about the trial. You would see Dick DeGuerin, the defense attorney for Durst, jump out of his seat quite a lot. I saw Durst. I saw DeGuerin in court in Las Vegas in action. Dick DeGuerin, and he was not as energetic during this trial as he was during the Galveston trial and during the trial I saw him in. I was in the courtroom in Las Vegas for an unrelated case. But the judge had certain things they were allowed to say and certain things the defense was not allowed to say. Otherwise, it could have very easily turned into a mistrial. But the Eureka case, and I interviewed all the people up in that area too, the Eureka case was important for, because there was a lot of evidence, was important for the Los Angeles investigation because it basically called him a serial killer, you know, three or more, and you're a serial killer.
Sure.
And so it widened. If they couldn't get him on Susan, they would help Eureka and try to get him on another case. But what it also did for them is it gave them, because they were investigating Durst up in the San Francisco area, and Eureka area, Northern California, they were able to follow his footsteps a little bit more. And that gave them, they shared evidence, and that gave them more fodder to bring an indictment against Durst. So two departments working together was greatly in favor of the Susan Berman case.
What helped too was that he was a flight risk. So regardless of the money that he had in this regard, there was not going to be any kind of bond. What we didn't talk about in this case was that when he originally was charged for the Morris Black murder and he had marijuana on him and a handgun, they didn't know who he was. Authorities didn't know who he was. Tell us about that.
Right. And then he ends up, you know, one point he gets arrested in Pennsylvania in his college town. They didn't know who he was either. So when Galveston first got him, he goes in and they, Pennsylvania or Galveston. They get him into a room, you know, to interview him, ask him questions. And in Pennsylvania, of course, he was arrested for stealing a Band-Aid and a tuna fish sandwich.
Yeah.
And they didn't know who he was. And he left. And he thought it was funny because he had fake IDs. He was fake identities. He was fake, you know, masks and all kinds of things and wigs that he would wear. So Durst was actually getting the kick out of it, the fact that police had him and they let him go. But eventually, of course, they, you know, he did end up in a Galveston courtroom.
You talk about the trial of Susan Berman and then the trial of Kathy Durst. Obviously, he is convicted. You said this case started in 2019, but then with the COVID, so they only had a week at trial originally, and then it was postponed. So the interim, you say like they wheeled him in with a wheelchair and his health was failing. He sure looked like, you know, he had aged quite a bit while he was in custody. Just tell us about how long it was and what he did die from in prison.
It was about a year. There were lots of delays in the case, and it was about a year before they tried him at the LA airport courtroom. And he had cancer of the bladder, and he had, I think, COPD. He had lung problems, but he had a catheter in court, which he proudly, smilingly lifted and said, you know, judge asked a question about it or something. He lifted and showed it to the judge with a smile on his face. And, you know, the bag was urine in it. And he was just, he liked to shock people. But so his health continued failing. He was hospitalized and the trial had to stop again. And then he got COVID and couldn't attend some of the hearings. And everybody thought he was going to die of COVID, and he didn't. And he ended up being convicted and then sent to the correction center's hospital, which was far worse than, you know, he was at the UCLA hospital before that, I think.
Right.
While in LA. But then he was in prison until when did he die? In December?
January 10th.
Yeah, January 10th. So the trial ended and he went to prison for a couple of months. And they were taking him for an appointment. He was in the prison hospital They wheeled him over and took him to an appointment for testing and for some sort of medical test. And in the testing, in the doctor's office, is when he went into cardiac arrest, and they couldn't revive him, and he died. So he died in custody, which is what the family wanted. But they were, I mean, I talked to his family, Kathy Durst's family, and Susan Berman's cousin several times, and they were so afraid he was going to die during the trial and that there would be no conviction. And it was a relief when he was convicted and he was still alive. And then Westchester County worked, because some evidence came out during his own testimony into Kathy Durst's case, and they were able to take that new evidence for themselves and file charges and indict Robert Durst for Kathy Durst's murder. And so for the McCormick family, which was Kathy Durst's maiden name, I talked to her brother, for the family, they can now, that nobody ever has to ever refer to Kathy Durst's case as the disappearance of Kathy Durst, because he was charged with murder, not convicted, but charged. Now they officially can call it the murder of Kathy Durst. And that gives them, you know, quit calling, quit saying she disappeared. We know she was murdered. Now it's a matter of fact. And that brought great, great relief to the family and some closure for Kathy Durst's family.
It's interesting, too, when you talk about relief for Kathy Durst's family, but when Susan Berman was first murdered, it took days for people to find out, friends to find out what had happened. And it seemed like, and you write, that it seemed like that the police already realized, or the media at least concluded, that this was a mob hit. And so maybe not, she was not afforded the same kind of attention and care as somebody else because of this past involving her father. But at least with Robert Durst's conviction of her murder, that was all put to rest, that the mob or anything she said or wrote about the mob or was going to say about the mob had really nothing to do with this. And it was just the murderous Robert Durst.
Exactly. And it was quite stunning, actually, when they said the mob did it, because they saw the poster, you know, above the fireplace, that wanted poster for her dad for murder. And I think her, you know, she sort of lived in squalor, and I think that it was just another murder. And then it took off, you know, the media got a hold of it. It was Susan Berman, daughter of, Davy Berman, who was a mobster in Las Vegas. And the story took off. But then they didn't, when they couldn't get a hold of Robert Durst. And I mean, you don't give up just because you can't get a hold of somebody, the person who's the suspect. And they looked at one of her friends, a manager, he was a person of interest for a little while. And he didn't do it, of course. And Susan had some relationships that she fell out, you know, she would cut people off, or she'd have a falling out with someone. Either they really liked her or they didn't like her. She was quirky and eccentric, and those who really stuck with her were diehard fans or friends. And so they looked at different people, but they didn't, because they couldn't reach him. You know, why does that stop an investigation? Because you've got a powerful man with money and his father makes phone calls. They should have continued pursuing it. And I can tell you, over the years, I would follow up regularly. I went to Parker Center, where they used to be, the LAPD, and would interview the new homicide cop, because her case, the homicide cops, I've never counted them, but there were a lot of them on her case. And it's like, oh, we're continuing, we're doing this, we're doing that, but nothing was being done. And it really did take that latest detective who jumped on it, and because of the phone call from Eureka Police, and David Lewin, the deputy district attorney, gets huge credit along with the detective. They are the men responsible getting the conviction for Robert Durst. It's a monumental moment that this was finally put to rest, and Kathy Durst's murder along with it, because everything sort of has gone hand in hand. So it's quite a full circle.
Yeah, it's interesting you say too, 40 years after he killed his wife in 1982, he dies in prison almost to the day. What's somewhat reassuring is that after you do write that after this whole thing is that there is not a resurgence, but a renewed interest in the writings and a respect for the writings of Susan Berman, their journalism, her novels, and her highly acclaimed book and the subsequent documentary, Easy Street. So at least that legacy, the thing that she wanted to be known for, the thing that she tried to achieve her whole life, this recognition for writing in death and post-death, at least she has some of that respect that she tried to earn throughout her career.
Yeah, you put that very well, Dan. It is very true that finally she was recognized for the things she fought so hard for. She tried to become a screenwriter. She didn't succeed. Her financial problems, weighed her down a lot. She always had a new deal coming. She was energetic and excited and loved writing. And now, people are taking a new look at what she did and her breadth of work, actually. She went to Berkeley Journalism School, which was a very fine school, and stayed in touch with her. She got a master's degree in journalism and made a big splash in San Francisco as a journalist there. She rose to the top, if there's a pecking order when it comes to journalism careers. So it is nice to see that she's looked at as a person instead of the person who got murdered by Robert Durst.
Yes. I want to thank you very much, Kathy Scott, for coming on and talking about your new Murder of a Mafia Daughter, expanded and updated 20th anniversary edition, Robert Durst and Susan Berman, The Shocking Inside Story. For those that might want to take a look, is there a Facebook page or a website they might take a look at?
They can go to kathyscott.com, but all my books and this latest 20th anniversary edition are on amazon.com. But make sure they put 20th anniversary so they don't get the earlier editions.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Kathy Scott. It's been a fascinating interview. Thank you so much, and you have a great evening. Good night.
My pleasure. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.